Welcome, everybody, to the first week of August. We're with Mayor Jim Lineup from Columbus, Indiana, via Zoom again. We might start, we'll have to see how it goes. I was going to ask you, but maybe next month we'll start back with in-person visits. It depends what your setup guidelines are there and, of course, right, how we feel here. But we haven't been to Columbus since April, I believe, and it'd be nice to see a lot of the stuff that's going on over there. And
love to have you. Yeah, I don't know how I look with the mask on, but my guess is that a month from now it's not going to be much different than it is right now.
Yeah.
In terms of the situation that we're facing, and
right.
And so we'll just wait and see. But yeah, we'd welcome you back to Columbus.
So, of course, we haven't talked to you in about a month. Hospitalizations are going up, cases are up, but testing is up too. What's your number one concern right now in Columbus?
Well, the number one concern is when school reopens, whether or not we'll get a rekindling of the disease here. We've been very fortunate in Columbus as a community. We've posted some pretty good numbers. I mean, we've had some, people get sick, we've had some deaths. And so to say that we've had good numbers is a little bit of cold comfort to those who've lost a loved one. But from a community's perspective, it's really turned out reasonably well. One of the metrics that we watch most closely is the number of inpatients at Columbus Regional Health. And those numbers have been pretty good. We've had a high of 20 back in April. The last number I got was much closer to 5. It's been as low as 0. So, I'd say right now we're in a pretty good shape, but we know that with school and school sports and some other activities that typically ramp up in the fall, with those coming on, we're a little concerned about that, and so we'll be paying pretty close attention.
I know in Bloomington, IU Health is starting to see much higher hospitalizations, and most of it, though, the concern is you can only really have one person per room, and so they're starting to fill up the hospital. And I assume that, the same would be at Columbus Regional and others. It doesn't sound like you're in that phase where you're starting to worry about moving people to other hospitals yet, are you?
No, not yet. Again, we sort of leave that up to the folks at CRH, but no, we've not stressed their capacity to that point.
And you mentioned schools too. I was going to ask you about that. How much is the city or county been involved in reopening schools? And just for those who don't know, who are listening from outside of Columbus, what is the reopening plan for schools there?
Well, in general, they'll be open. There'll be an e-learning option available. The school administrators have told me that they expect about 1/3 of the students to take the e-learning option, but that might be a little high, maybe 1/4. But that option will be available for those families that want to pursue that. Those folks who do go to school every day, and this would include the teachers and the administrators, will have a screening process that they have to go through. So there will be a temperature check, either when they enter the building or when they get on the bus. There will also be some screening questions about what's going on with the health in your family, today. And the whole notion is to try to identify those people who are most at risk, either because of their temperature spike or because of something else that's going on in the household, and sort of pull them out of the queue and give them a little bit further screening. Again, the whole notion would be to try to identify early the places where we have an issue and to begin to do some kind of contact tracing with respect to where those people have been and who they've been in touch with, so that we hopefully can get try to get our arms around their exposure to the disease. And it occurs to me that, we've got about 11,000 students within BCSC, Bartholomew Consolidated Schools. We've got a couple thousand teachers and administrators. If you've got 80% of those who show up, you might have 9,000 to 10,000 a day who get tested. And so I think that's a pretty good number. I mean, I think that's a pretty good swath of the local population. And it'll not only tell us what's going on with that individual, but what's going on in that individual's family. So our expectation is that if we have some issues, we should know sooner, rather than later. We'll know sooner when they begin to develop, like say, a fever, or somebody in the family has some kind of symptom that they display. And hopefully we'll be able to get onto that a little sooner than, like I say, sooner than later. And you keep in mind too, that a lot of the larger employers are doing similar kind of screening. So our expectation is that once school resumes, even though we've got heightened risk because there will be, greater proximity, for a big number of people, the amount of screening that's going on in the county is substantial. And so our expectation is that if we develop a problem, we should be able to find out early.
You mentioned contact tracing. The more I read about it, the more important that is. Is there a threshold for schools there where, you start to, you see the one positive case and then maybe, you're seeing this in Major League Baseball where a whole team has been quarantined for, a few weeks, or even football practices at Terre Haute and Bloomington. Is there a certain threshold where it gets shut down?
Yeah, the school corporation's developed a list of metrics, and I just can't keep that stuff off the top of my head. But if you go to their website, you can access that pretty easily yourself. And yeah, it takes into account the number of positive test results and the results of their screenings and so forth, number of kids or people out on quarantine. And if they get enough factors that are flashing red, then they'll react to that. And we'll just pay attention and play it as we see it.
Mm-hmm. I know many city and county officials were debating the mask or coming up with some type of mask guideline for their city or county. And then because it didn't look like Governor Holcomb was going to enact some type of statewide mandate. And then all of a sudden the statewide mandate came out. How did you feel about that and the city residents, and what is the participation like in the mask mandate?
Yeah, well, I'll start with the end first. We've been very pleased with the compliance with the mask mandate. From my own perspective, if I go to one of the big box retailers, which is really where most of our concerns were, I see people in the parking lot without a mask on, but they got one in their hand. And as they walk up to the door, they put it on before they go inside the building. And that's the kind of compliance that we're looking for. Again, and when I go in, I'm just walking up and down the aisles, just checking to see what people are doing. And we're in the high 90s in terms of percentage of compliance. It's really kind of heartening. When we first began to talk about a mask mandate here, law enforcement was very concerned that we would be overwhelmed with calls that, there's a guy in aisle 12 who doesn't have his mask on, and so you need to come out and deal with that. And we just haven't had that. Since Governor Holcomb came forward with his announcement, I think we've had three calls to the 911 center. And so that's the kind of statistic that we're looking for. And in my mind, it just indicates that people get it. They understand that this is an airborne pathogen, and the best way for you to protect yourself, your loved ones, and others is to wear a mask. And so, no, it's not fun. It's pretty inconvenient. I don't have my glasses on right now because I'm getting used to not wearing them. But people are complying. They're doing what they need to do. We had one of our county health officers stood up at, I think it was the last school board meeting, and said that the city and he were in conversations about putting together a mask order for the city of Columbus. And that generated a fair amount of discussion. And he and I, and several others, this wasn't the two of us, but spent a fair amount of time trying to figure out what that should look like. We took a look at the orders that had been put forward by for Marion County and for Monroe County, as well as a couple others, different places. And Evansville, I think we looked at that one as well. And based on those, came forward with what we thought would be, reasonable set of guidelines for Columbus. And we were in my office at the table behind my head here and prepared to sign when somebody stuck their head in the door and said the governor had just announced a statewide order for Indiana. So from that perspective, I felt a little bit vindicated because we had a number of folks who had challenged us on, why we would do this and whether it was really the smart thing to do or the thing to do. And so it was kind of heartening to see the governor come forward with pretty close to what we were thinking about. We read his order and realized that there was really nothing that we needed to add. But yeah, we were prepared to go forward with the mask order, and he sort of, I don't know what you want to call it, came to the rescue, cavalry, you know, right there at the last minute.
And just really quick, is there any type of, I know he left it up to city county to enforce that. Is there a special number people call? Are you telling law enforcement to enforce this?
Well, what we do is we're keeping track of the calls and routing all of this through the county health department. And the notion is that we try to draw a distinction between events and a pattern. And if you've got an event, you got a guy or a person out at, a convenience store who goes in to get a soft drink and doesn't wear a mask. And you know, by the time we would get there, he'd be gone. And that's an event. And so we really are not going to try to respond to those. On the other hand, if we get, two dozen calls that at a particular convenience store at this particular location, the employees are not masked up and there's nobody, asking customers to put on a mask, well, then, yeah, we're going to go out and we're going to visit that place. I mean, and so, again, what we're trying to do is just identify locations that need a little bit of attention. When we find one of those, again, what we'll do is go out and have a conversation. And it won't be any really different than what the county health department already does with respect to their inspections of restaurants and grocery stores and, other food type places. I mean, they'll go out and, check for compliance. And when they don't see it, then, there's a little protocol that they go through that starts with conversation about, how do we get to where we need to be?
Columbus is...
We've just not had an issue.
Mm-hmm. Columbus has been the recipient of some Transportation CARES Act money. It came in two different announcements. There was $2.3 million a few weeks ago, then $140,000 just this past week. Why were there two different sums?
Oh, I...
Who knows, huh?
I couldn't tell you why it came in, in two installments. But we were pleased to receive, and... the first thought was that we would put that money towards buses. But, the truth is that we bought new buses a couple of years ago, and these buses have a 10 to 15 year life. I mean, it's not like they're need to be replaced. And so we're taking a look at some alternative uses. You basically have to go back and reread the rules and see what else is permissible. And so we're in the process of doing that. And it's going to take us another month or so to sort of sort through, what we could spend the money on that would be meaningful to us. Like I said, I don't know that we need any more buses right now, but we'll try to put the money to good use.
And a lot of that goes for screened, like pandemic things that you don't think about on a bus, cleaning, plexiglass, things like that, right?
Yeah, part of what we're trying to do is provide some protection first for the driver. I mean, the driver is in the bus for however many hours it is. Now, they get out and take a break from time to time, but they're pretty much continually exposed to whatever's going on in there. And obviously, we're concerned about the riders and exposure that comes from proximity to another rider. But we've been able to distance out the buses. I mean, distance out the seating, I should say, on the buses, and feel like that's pretty well taken care of. But yeah, it's a challenge because, you've got some people who come on to the bus where they have the mask, but some don't. Some understand the seating guidelines, some don't. And so it's up to the driver to try to educate the riders with respect to that. And it's a challenge. But so far, like I said, we've had very few complaints, mostly all compliance.
What's a paratransit bus?
I would think that that's for somebody who has some kind of a disability.
Okay.
Paraplegic kind of person. And we have, we typically have, I can't think of the word I want to use, but it's a gate with a lift that allows wheelchair or scooter type access. And then the bus driver will help lock that vehicle in place, or lock that wheelchair, for example, in place.
And I see. Okay.
They're not seat belts, but I can't think of the word I want to use.
Yeah. I just saw that in the release as part of something that this would be for. So I don't know what that was. Are there other parts of the city budget? I mean, this is transportation, which is important too, although not as many people probably using it, but it definitely helps. But that gets hit with the pandemic. I mean, we're in month five right now. Are there any other, like, you know, trouble areas that the city is worried about?
Well, we're always worried, but property taxes are by design a fairly stable revenue source for local government. And so we think that is a good thing, other than, you know, if you've got a business that's suffering, they, you know, they still have to pay the property tax. And so it becomes a little bit of a problem from that perspective. But we're going to see a significant increase, or excuse me, a significant decrease in our local income tax revenues. We don't know yet, you know, how much, a million, you know, maybe two. It's just really hard to say. And it's probably not going to hit us until 2022. The funding formula that the state of Indiana uses is very involved, but it's more like a, what I would call a rolling average. And in essence, before you feel the pain, you have to wait for a couple of good years to drop off and a couple of bad years to work their way into the formula. And so if you think of it in those terms and you think that 2020 is going to be a bad year and 2021 will be a bad year, we're probably not going to feel that until 2022. And so, you know, our expectations are that 2021 revenues will be relatively flat compared to 2020. But we are going to try to get all of our capital needs, or at least the significant ones that we can identify, taken care of in 2021, in anticipation that 2022 is going to be a tough year.
And I know some cities are dipping into a rainy day fund. Is that something that Columbus has?
We have a rainy day fund, and I want to say the balance is around $5 million. We've also got a pretty healthy general fund, and I want to say the balance there is $22 million. So, you know, we're well capitalized. I mean, I don't think we're going to have that kind of an issue. In terms of just running out of money, I mean, that's not going to happen. But it's still, that's sort of the last case scenario for us. I mean, we really do want to pay as we go and not dip into our reserves and see if we can't make that work. But at the same time, we all know that roads and streets deteriorate whether the economy says it's okay to do so. And so we'll continue with our pavement and overlay programs simply because if you don't, I mean, you just defer the make, because with capital projects, I mean, you don't not spend it, you just defer it. It comes due at some point, but we will want to try to get that covered without having to get into our reserves. But again, if we have to, that's what they're there for. I mean, you know, is to be able to provide some kind of cushion during difficult times. And, you know, I don't know how long you would expect diminished revenues to exist. If it would go into 2023, it might, hard to say yet, but my guess would be that if 2022 is affected, 2023 will also. And so you're thinking about trying to find some money for a couple of years, and we're able to do that. I mean, we've got the funding to do that if we need to.
Well, I know we're about out of time, but I just wanted to get maybe an update. I know there's a lot of other things that we always talk about. It's the railway overpass. I hear Fair Oaks has a master plan, and the hotel conference center even is still making some progress despite a pandemic. Do you want to kind of pick one and give us an update?
Well, we were always willing to talk about the overpass. It's the most fun thing we got going. And our expectation here is that by the middle of August, we'll be driving both ways into town and out of town and north and south. I mean, you know, there's some other ramps there. And you know, some people have called me and told me it's a lot like a roller coaster, that they just really enjoy driving the thing. It's kind of anything new, you know, is fun to start with. But it really is an improvement in with respect to safety. And we're quite convinced that once the economy picks back up, the level of train traffic is going to increase as well. The railroad is working on a siding north of us up in Johnson County. And when that is done, they will then have two sidings, one down around Scott County in addition to the one north of us. And that will allow trains to pass. And we will begin to see, we believe, pretty heavy two-way traffic. Right now, most all the traffic runs northbound. And when I say traffic, the big trains, the 10,000-foot ones. But once those sidings are completed, we should see, you know, train traffic, 10,000 foot train traffic in both directions. So we're really excited to get that behind us and see that kind of an improvement to safety and just transportation in and out of our community. You mentioned Fair Oaks. We're going to put that on pause because of some of the revenue issues that we talked about a moment ago. The Hotel Conference Center, it's going to go forward, but on a slower schedule. We have really, we sort of viewed it as one project north of 2nd Street and then a mixed-use development south of 2nd Street. We've de-linked those. The mixed-use development south of 2nd Street will continue pretty much on schedule. We hope to have a shovel in the ground in March of 2021 because those kind of developments don't seem to be affected too much by the economic issues that we're facing. But the Hotel Conference Center will clearly be delayed for at least a year, if not a little longer. They're just going to have to wait for the lenders to get comfortable with that kind of an investment again. But the developer that we've worked with, the Spriggs, and with their contacts at Marriott, they continue to be excited, you know, about the project and want it to go forward. They just need for the economy to sort of rebound. But yeah, it's a fun time. There's still a lot going on, and we've got plenty to manage, so it's all good.
And you're getting some money to clean up the gas station at the city.
Right. Yeah, I forgot to mention that. A little bit east of where I sit, there's a former convenience store, had been owned by the local farmers cooperative. We bought it, I'll say a year ago, and when we knew that there were some underground storage tanks there that would have to be removed. We were hopeful that they would not be a real problem. And to date, that's what it's turned out. I mean, all the environmental testing that we've done there has been what they call non-detect. But thankfully, we applied for assistance from Indiana's POSI Fund, and it's an acronym, and don't ask me what it stands for, but they've agreed to remove all the tanks. There are 11 underground storage tanks, so they will remove those, and they'll remove whatever portion of the superstructure, the concrete, the building, whatever they have to get to those. So we're hopeful that when they're done, there'll be very little left for us to take care of.
And what does the city want to do with that land?
Well, in the short run, we'll just put some dirt on it and some grass. Long term, it will continue to be a portion of the 2nd Street development. I mean, from my perspective, I'd like to see us develop 2nd Street all the way down, well, out to the Hawk Creek, and then, you know, hop that and go on out to East High School. But it'll just become part of that when the time comes. A big part of what that does for us is it reduces the number of property owners in that area. To essentially, in the area that I'm thinking of, there's only two. There's ourselves, the Redevelopment Commission, which owns this ground, some of which will be part of the mixed-use development we talked about a moment ago. But then there's another, you know, privately owned property just further east out to the Hawk Creek. And the point is that instead of dealing with four or five people that you've got to deal with if you want to develop that ground, now you're down to two. And one of those is the city, you know. And so we just think it facilitates whatever might come next. It just makes the dealing a little bit easier to do.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate seeing you in August already.
it's hard to believe we're here already, but you're welcome. And yeah, look forward to September.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye.